On a blistering hot day in South Australia, the beaches are flooded with people looking to cool off, relax, and enjoy the celebration of Australia Day. But in Somerton, Jim and Nancy Beaumont are in a panic. Their three children, 9-year-old Jane, 7-year-old Anna, and 4-year-old Grant, have not returned from a visit to nearby Glenelg Beach. At 10:10 a.m., Nancy put her children on the bus for the 5-minute ride to the beach. They had gone many times before and had been to the beach just the previous day. Typically, they would ride their bikes down, but on this day, Nancy decides that with it being so hot, they should take the bus instead. It's just another beach trip to Nancy, but this day, her children would never make it back home. They were meant to take the 12 p.m. bus and to be back home for lunch, but by 3:30 p.m., there's still no sign of them. Jim and Nancy begin frantically searching everywhere for their kids. When they're unable to locate them, they call the police to report them missing, and January 26, 1966 becomes a day which lives in infamy in the annals of Australian crime history. The largest search effort in the history of the country to that time is launched, with police and volunteers combing over every inch of space within miles of the beach. Many witnesses come forward reporting sightings of the children in the company of an unidentified man in the hours and minutes before they vanish. According to their reports, the three children played with the man under the sprinklers of a park, and then proceeded to a local cake shop where they purchased some snacks with a £1 note that their mother says they did not have with them when they left their home that morning. Did the unidentified man provide them with this money? Within hours of the disappearance, the locals are aware, and within days, it's a national news story being covered by every paper, radio station, and television news network. Despite a massive outpouring of support by the public, no new leads are developed, and the police grow frustrated with the lack of evidence. Police almost immediately believe they are dealing with an abduction and put the roads, rail stations, and airports on lockdown, but they're hours behind the suspect, since they weren't made aware of the disappearance until 7:30 p.m., and the last sighting of the children was at approximately 12 p.m. Over the next 51 years, many theories would be developed, and a psychic would come to Australia claiming to have seen the children buried beneath the earth in one of his visions. After leading authorities to two separate locations, no trace of the children is found. A series of letters arrive, claiming to be written by Jane, and suggesting that the man who has them will return them, but this turns out to be a terrible hoax. Jim and Nancy are at their wits' end, and as the years pass, they slowly come to accept that they will never see their children alive again. A short list of suspects develops over time, all of which have ties to violent and sexual crimes. Despite desperate attempts, little evidence can be found to tie any of them to the crime against the Beaumont children, and all of these years later, there still has been no trace discovered. Police begin to theorize that the children may have known their abductor, and in fact, may have spent previous days at the beach in his company. Were the children abducted by someone they had met previously? Did a total stranger grab the children and take them away? Were they victims of a vicious child killer and murdered within hours of their disappearance? Or does a diary given to police in 2017 finally hold the name of the perpetrator? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 14, The Disappearance of the Beaumont Children. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode focuses on the heartbreaking disappearance of the Beaumont children, who went missing from Australia on January 26, 1966. It's a well-known case, and although I tend to focus on lesser-known cases, this has been the most requested case I've been contacted about, and it's about time I did a case for my Australian listeners, who represent the second-largest number of listeners in the world for the Trace Evidence podcast. Before moving into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms and on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and more. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon page. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on our official website at trace-evidence.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, tweet me at traceevpod, that's TraceEvPod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on our website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. And I want to thank those of you who have contacted me in recent weeks suggesting your cases. They've been added to my list, and I'll be investigating them soon. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to these cases. Today we examine the disappearance of the Beaumont children. This is a case which has always baffled me and very much disturbs me. It does involve young children, and there is some content relating to suspects who have a history of sex offenses, so some listener discretion is advised. I want to thank all the Australian listeners on the Facebook group who helped me with the pronunciation of some of the names and locations involved in this case. I'll do my best not to mess them up too badly. This is episode 14, The Disappearance of the Beaumont Children. Glenelg is a beachside suburb of Adelaide, the capital of South Australia, that boasts sandy beaches, beautiful blue skies, and crisp, cool water. Over the years, it has maintained its reputation and become a popular beach venture for tourists and locals alike. The shore sits nestled beneath the growing landscape of high-rise apartment complexes and hotels, providing all that can be needed for a traveler seeking a gorgeous place to spend his time. The skyline is somewhat sacrificed, as the angular edifices cut into the blue with their skin of gleaming steel and glass. Today, Glenelg thrives as a tourist destination, offering heavenly views as well as hosting the Glenelg Tigers football team, the Glenelg Seahorses cricket team, as well as shopping on Jetty Road and the ever-growing popularity of recreational boating. 51 years ago, before it was known around the world as the place to be in South Australia, Glenelg was a quiet suburb known for its majesty. But all that would change on Australia Day, January 26, 1966, when a horrifying disappearance would shock Glenelg and all of Australia for years to come. In 1955, ex-serviceman Grant Beaumont, known to all as Jim or Jimmy, meets, courts, and marries a local named Nancy Ellis. The two move to the suburbs of Somerton Park, living in a home at 109 Harding Street. The suburbs of Adelaide at this time were picturesque and often referred to as the perfect place to raise a family. Town populations were low, and in Somerton Park, they found the kind of place where everyone knew everyone and people didn't worry about locking their doors. By January of 1966, Nancy and Jim have three small children. The eldest, Jane, is born in 1956, just a year after Jim and Nancy are married. 2 years later, in 1958, their second daughter, Anna, is born, and she is followed 3 years later by the only boy, Grant, in 1961. In January of 66, Jane is 9 years old and tasked with looking out for her other siblings, 7-year-old Anna and 4-year-old Grant. The children frequently travel to the beach in nearby Glenelg, often by themselves. Although from a 2017 perspective, it's easy to view this with a sideways glance, 1966 was a different time. And considering the perceived safety and friendliness of the area, it wasn't unheard of for young children to be let off on their own for a day at the beach. On Wednesday, January 26, 1966, it was a blistering hot day for Adelaide and its suburbs. It was also Australia Day, essentially the same as the 4th of July is for Americans. It's a celebratory day, and Jim had a decision to make. Though he would have preferred to have stayed home and spent the holiday with his family, he had previously arranged a meeting to see clients 2 hours away in Snowtown. Jim was a salesman, and rather than pass up the sale, he figured he could make the drive, complete his work, and be home in time to spend the late afternoon and evening with the family. Jim would later state that he regretted that decision for the rest of his life. After he left for the day, Nancy decided to allow the children to go down to Glenelg Beach for a few hours, rather than have them lingering around the home on such a hot, beautiful morning, wasting away their summer holiday. The children would normally ride their bikes down to the beach, as they had just the previous day, but with the weather being as hot as it was, and with the likelihood of increased traffic due to the holiday, Nancy tells the children to take the bus instead. The bus stop was at the intersection of Diagonal Road and Harding Street, less than 100 meters from their home. All three children wore bathing suits, shorts, and sandals. Jane, being the oldest, had the responsibility of carrying a shoulder bag which contained their beach towels. Nancy told the children to take the noon bus home for lunch. There was a large clock tower in Glenelg by which the children would know what time to catch the bus. This would be the last time Nancy Beaumont would ever see her three children. Jane was described as being 130 centimeters tall, or 4 foot 5 inches, with ear-length hair, pushed back, fair-colored. She was possibly wearing a yellow ribbon in her hair. She had a thin face, freckles, and hazel eyes with slightly buck teeth. She was prone to stuttering when she was excited. On January 26th, she was wearing green shorts over a pink bathing suit. Her sandals were canvas with white soles. She was carrying a white purse, a paperback copy of Little Women, and a bluish-green airport travel-style shoulder bag with three towels inside. Jane was also carrying 8 shillings and 6 pence for the bus ride and snacks. Arna was described as being 122 centimeters tall, or 4 feet, with a thicker build. She had dark brown hair and a tan complexion with dark brown eyes. She was wearing tan shorts over a red and white striped bathing suit and tan sandals. Grant is described as being 91 centimeters tall, or just under 3 feet. He had a thin build with brown hair and brown eyes. He was also tanned, and often referred to as having an olive complexion. He was last seen wearing green cotton shorts over a green bathing suit with a vertical white stripe and red sandals. At approximately 10:10 a.m., the three children boarded the bus headed for the beach. The bus was driven by a Mr. Monroe, who would later confirm the children being present on the bus that morning. A female passenger also remembered seeing the girls on the bus, specifically recollecting Jane holding her copy of Little Women. The bus traveled northwest along Diagonal Road, turning north onto Brighton Road, west onto Jetty Road, and made a stop at Mosley Street, a short walk from the beach. At this point in time, the three children stepped off the bus, and the time is thought to be approximately 10:15 a.m. A local postman named Tom Patterson reports spotting the children at approximately 11 a.m. walking down Jetty Road, away from the beach. Patterson knew the children by sight, and claims one of them exclaimed, quote, "It's the postie," end quote. Patterson described the children as walking hand in hand and laughing. It should be noted that when initially interviewed, Patterson could not recall if he spotted the children at the beginning of his route or at the end. This is a somewhat debated sighting, as Patterson would later state that he actually saw the children at approximately 3 p.m., and investigators would question why the children would be haphazardly wandering down the road laughing when they would have known they were late and likely going to be shouted at upon returning home. Through further investigation, it's believed that Patterson did in fact see the children, and the most likely time was approximately 11 a.m. What exactly caused the confusion for Mr. Patterson is unknown, though he would ultimately agree with the earlier time frame. There was also some debate about the specific time the children left their home, with certain reports noting that they left as early as 8:40 a.m. or as late as 1 p.m. But much of this has been chalked up to Jim Beaumont's stress and confusion at the time he was speaking to investigators. The bus driver and passenger who reported seeing the children were able to corroborate Nancy's timeline of a 10:10 a.m. bus trip, and that is the time investigators believe is accurate to their departure. With her husband at work and the children away at the beach, Nancy stepped out to visit a neighbor. She arrived home just prior to the arrival of the 12 p.m. bus, but the children were not on it. Nancy didn't think this was too weird, as the children often walked home from the beach, and she presumed it possible that they had missed their bus and were walking home, or that they simply made the choice to walk home instead of hopping on the bus. The next bus would arrive at 2 p.m., and she decided to wait and assume they would arrive on it. When the 2 p.m. bus arrived and the children failed to return home, Nancy began growing more concerned. She considered walking down to the beach by the way the children would normally travel, but she worried that she could possibly miss them if they took a different route, and she doesn't want to not be home when they arrive, so she waits. When a 3 p.m. bus stopped at the corner of Diagonal Road and Harding Street, the intersection at which the children had been picked up, and they failed to step off the bus, Nancy becomes frightened. At approximately 3:30 p.m., Jim arrived home from work. His clients had been unable to attend the meeting. Nancy met him in the yard. She was frantic about the children having gone to the beach and not returned. Jim tried his best to calm Nancy and told her that he would take a drive down to the beach and look for them. After searching all around the beach area and the most likely path home, Jim stopped back at the house and picked up Nancy, telling her that he needed her help to look for them. Jim and Nancy traveled once more over the same path and began stopping by the homes of friends and neighbors asking if they'd seen the children. When no one had, and they could no longer control their worry, they phoned the police to report the children missing. The phone call to police was made at approximately 7:30 p.m. after Jim and Nancy felt they had exhausted all options and couldn't think of where else to look. A handwritten call log for the time states the following, quote, "The three children left home for the beach at Glen Elg at 8:40 a.m. on January 26, 1966. They traveled by bus leaving Harding Street at 8:45 a.m. The children were seen on the lawns at the Colliery Reserve during the morning. They failed to return home that afternoon. Since then, no trace of the children can be found." End quote. Again, we see different times here, but as previously mentioned, this is considered possible misinformation due to Jim placing the call and being distraught. In addition to this information, Jim also informs the police that Jane could barely swim and that Arna and Grant certainly could not swim. Officers were dispatched and began searching, and Jim went along with them to search the beach. An official timeline of events states the following. At 8:40 p.m., police searched the Brighton foreshore as well as the West Beach and Henley Beach, but no sign of the children is found. At 9:50 p.m., the Sea Rescue Squadron volunteers offer to search the coastline. The police decline this offer on an official basis, but inform the volunteers that they may search unofficially if they so choose to. At 10 p.m., the police call Jim, and he explains that he has called every friend, family member, and neighbor that he can think of, but no one has seen the children. At 10:17 p.m., police report they have searched ships at Boat Haven and surrounding areas, but have found nothing. The next morning, on Thursday, January 27th, the children are officially listed as missing persons and a massive search is launched for them under the light of day. The coastline was searched for several kilometers north and south of Glen Elg Beach. The police believe that they should be able to find some signs of the children, even if only items they are known to have been in possession of at the time they disappeared, but nothing is located. Jim and Nancy are frantic, and Nancy is sedated to help her cope. Jim continues to attempt to assist in search efforts, but is told to stay home and wait for word from the police. Jim had previously been a taxi driver, and when his former co-workers find out about the disappearance, 40 of them volunteer and join in the search efforts. Jim visits the police station twice a day looking for updates, and police install a special phone line in his home so that they can reach him directly. Police almost immediately rule out the possibility of a runaway situation, as children rarely run off in groups, and they're typically running from something. They find no reason that any of the three children would voluntarily elect to run away from the Beaumont home. This leaves them with two grim possibilities: that the children were swept into the ocean and drowned, or that they were abducted. They begin canvassing the area the children were last known to be in, scouring for signs of them, and for witnesses who may have seen the children the previous day. Police manage to locate a 74-year-old woman who reports seeing the children the day they disappeared. According to this witness, she spotted all three children at approximately 11 a.m. She was sitting in front of the Holdfast Sailing Club building when she saw the three children playing under a sprinkler on the lawn of the Colliery Reserve. I've also read this account stating that the children were not playing at a sprinkler, but in fact a small washing device used to wash off sand and dirt from the beach. The Colliery Reserve is a small lawn area for game playing and picnicking located on Colliery Terrace, less than 0.3 kilometers or 0.2 miles from the beach. The witness would further state that there was a man in blue swimming trunks laying in the grass. She said the man appeared to be watching the children, and after several minutes, approached them at the sprinkler. The man appeared to be talking to the children and then began playing with them. The woman said that the children were laughing and flicking their towels at the man for several minutes. The man was described as being tall, blonde, and thin-faced with a suntanned complexion and a thin-to-athletic build, likely in his mid-30s. At this point, the witness loses track of them. Between 11 a.m. and 11:15 a.m., a schoolmate of Jane's reports seeing the three children, but she did not speak to them. At approximately 11:45 a.m., the three children entered Wenzel's cake shop and purchased some snacks and a meat pie. They paid for the items with a one-pound note. The shopkeeper was familiar with the children, stating that they had come in several times before, but that this occasion was different as they had never before purchased a meat pie. In addition to this purchase, there is the curiosity of the one-pound note, as Jane had only been given change by her mother. This leads investigators to believe that the children had received the money from someone other than their mother, and perhaps from the blonde-haired man seen with them earlier. Their arrival in the shop is 15 minutes before the 12 p.m. bus that they're meant to take home for lunch. Sometime around 12 p.m., several other witnesses spot the man and the children. One woman was sitting by herself on a bench at the Colliery Reserve when she saw the blonde-haired man and the three children walking together. Sitting on the bench was also a woman, her husband, and their granddaughter. The first woman positively identified Anna Beaumont as being one of the children, and believed that Jane and Grant were the other two. According to these witnesses, the man approached the bench and asked if they'd seen anyone going through his clothing that was laying on the grass because he was missing some money. The witnesses state that they told him they hadn't seen anything, and at this point, the man returned to the children. The man began dressing the children at this point, which the witnesses found very odd considering the children were old enough to dress themselves, and especially Jane, who was 9 years old at the time. According to Nancy, Jane was extremely shy, and she thought it highly unlikely she would allow a perfect stranger to dress her. But the witnesses say that Jane showed no hesitation and didn't appear to think this was out of the ordinary. All four witnesses said that the three children seemed to be friendly and comfortable with the unidentified man. Police began to theorize that this was not the first time the children had met the man. The level of comfort the children felt with him and the way in which they were willing to go along and play with him, plus the fact that they didn't seem disturbed by him dressing them, all adds up to this being someone that the children had met before. The children frequented the beach, and police believe that they had spent time with the man on a previous day. It's at this time that Nancy remembers a comment Anna had made previously. According to Nancy, after a trip to the beach, Anna had stated that Jane had, quote, got a boyfriend down the beach, end quote. At the time, Nancy thought she simply meant a friend that they played with. But in retrospect, both she and investigators begin to believe that this so-called boyfriend may have been the blonde man. After dressing the children, the man returned to his clothing and picked up a pair of trousers and a towel from the grass. At this point, the man and the three children began walking away. They were last seen passing behind the Glenelg Hotel, though one of the witnesses claimed she saw the four heading towards the Colliery Reserve changing rooms. This is the last officially verified sighting of the children, and police believe they went missing sometime between 12 and 12:15 p.m. that afternoon. There is another sighting which has never been verified. A man from Broken Hill alleges to have seen the three children and an adult male walking away from the beach. According to police, his description of the male matches that of previous witness statements, with one exception. He described the man as having brown, not blonde hair. This sighting takes place around 1:45 p.m., but due to contradictions in the description and no pieces of corroborating evidence, this sighting is not officially listed as being verified. In response to the likelihood of abduction, police put surveillance teams at the airport and rail stations to watch for anyone who may be attempting to take the children out of the area, and roadblocks are set up on major roads, but their efforts prove fruitless. Police theorized that the children were abducted sometime after 12 p.m., but were not notified of the children being missing until 7:30 p.m., and that window of nearly 7 hours granted any abductor the opportunity to get away before these measures could be taken. By the weekend, reports of the disappearance were national news, spreading all over Australia. Reporters flooded Glenelg, and Jim went on television making a plea for his children's safe return. Jim breaks down during his plea, and the response of viewers and listeners is both a blessing and a curse. The police are flooded with tips and have to divide their resources to follow possible leads on each call. former CIB detective Peter Vogel is put in charge of the case. In an interview regarding the tips, Vogel would state, quote, "We received quite a few telephone calls with people giving us information, as well as people calling at the station and telling us what they saw and what they believed could have happened," end quote. An article is printed in the Sunday Daily Mail newspaper with the headline, "Sex Crime Now Feared." In the article, it is alleged that investigators believe the children were murdered by a quote-unquote sex pervert. It goes on to discuss police theories that the children were likely murdered within a kilometer of the beach, and they cite how difficult it would be to simultaneously abduct three children without them making a scene as a foundation for their theory. By February, no substantial leads are acquired, and the government offers a reward of £200 for information about the disappearance of the Beaumont children. This small sum of money results in public outcry and a backlash from Jim and Nancy. Together with donations, they are able to bump up the reward to £10,000. In desperation to garner more sympathy from the public and to add to the dark reputation of their possible abductor, the police make the decision to print a letter in the paper, written by Jane to her parents on a night when they had left her in charge of her brother and sister. The letter, in totality, reads, quote, "Dear Mom and Dad, I am just about to go to bed and the time is 9. I have put Grant's nappy on, so there's no need to worry about his wetting the sheet. Grant wanted to sleep in his own bed, so one of you will have to sleep with Arna. Although you will not find the rooms in very good condition, I hope you will find them as comfortable as we do. Good night to you both, Jane. XXX. P.S. I hope you had a nice time wherever you went. P.P.S. I hope you don't mind me taking your radio into my room, Daddy." End quote. Nancy Beaumont had hung on to the letter, planning to give it to Jane when she had grown up. Unfortunately, she will never have the opportunity to deliver the letter to her daughter. On February 3rd, the Patawalonga boat haven is searched for bodies. Police divers searched the deep water while cadets waded through waist-deep mud with long poking forks, but no bodies were found. Later that day, Nancy held a press conference in the garden of their home. During the conference, Nancy admitted with difficulty that it was hard to imagine the children were still alive. When asked about reports of a man having been seen with the children, Nancy responded, quote, "If the other two were very keen to go with someone, Jane would go with them to look after them and wouldn't leave them alone," end quote. A sketch is developed based on descriptions of the fair-haired man last seen with the children. It becomes the most famous face in Australia despite its lack of defining characteristics. It's an extremely vague depiction of a thin-faced man with no identifying marks and appears almost as the ghost of an image rather than that of a face. The image is plastered all around Australia, along with photos of Jane, Anna, and Grant, but to no avail. Tips begin to dwindle, and police begin to scale back their investigation. Later, in March, ex-policeman Ray Kelly flew into Australia. He's highly respected by the New South Wales police, and had retired not long ago at the rank of detective inspector. He was Australia's most famous policeman at the time, and is now operating as a private investigator, hired by a Sydney newspaper to see what he can ascertain about the case. Kelly met with local investigators, but flew back out of Australia the next day. There's a lot of speculation about why he stayed for only a day, but many believe that information given to him by the police led him to believe that the case was too thin to make much of. Investigators are baffled, and outside of witness interviews within days of the disappearance, they've found no new evidence or signs of the children. The number of officers assigned to the case is cut back. In September, some 8 months after the disappearance, a new lead is presented to investigators. Senior Constable Ray Gross in the town of Caniva picks up his phone and finds his lines are crossed with someone else. While holding the phone to his ear, he hears a conversation between two women in which one woman mentions bringing the Beaumont children back from Hobart. He immediately calls the homicide squad and told them what he had heard. Detective Sergeant Stanley Swain deemed the call genuine. For the first time since the disappearance of the children, there was hope for the case. Jim and Nancy were informed of the development and began to consider the possibility that their three children would be found, but unfortunately, it was all a misunderstanding. On October 13th, investigators received two calls from two women who claimed they were the ones whose conversation Gross had overheard. According to them, They had been discussing the disappearance of the Beaumont children, but then changed topics and were discussing different children who were returning from a trip to Hobart. Many months after the disappearance, a woman called in a tip. According to the woman, on the night of the disappearance, she had seen a man accompanied by two girls and a boy entering a vacant house in her neighborhood. She stated that later that night she saw the boy walking alone down the road, but that he was pursued by the man and picked up. The next morning, the woman noted that the house was once again vacant and she saw no signs of the children nor the man. Police were unable to verify this sighting and were confused as to why the woman waited so long to report it. Police expressed their frustration with the case. According to their investigation, the children had with them at least 17 individual items, including clothing, towels, a book, and bags, yet not one single piece of evidence can be located. As the investigation begins to grow cold, a so-called psychic appears on the scene. In November of 1966, Gerard Croisset, a Dutch man and self-proclaimed clairvoyant, is flown into Adelaide by a local Dutch businessman named Jan van Schnee. Reportedly, Croisset had some success locating missing children in Europe, and van Schnee believes that he may be able to provide answers in the case of the Beaumont children. Initially, Croisset claims the children can be located within 800 meters or half a mile of where they had last been seen. Croisset requests video footage and photos of the area around Glenelg Beach. Barry Blackwell, a car salesman from Brighton and a friend to Nancy Beaumont, offers to pay for a helicopter to fly the coastline for Croisset. Croisset makes the startling claim that the children can be located, quote, under the earth in a cave, end quote. The film footage shot from the helicopter, along with a short documentary which covers the children's known travel on that day, is presented to Croisset. According to Croisset, he can see what happened to the children, and he explains that there was a pole with a warning sign on it, and nearby was a hole surrounded by dead grass. He states that the children went past this hole to a similar one, and crawled inside, at which point the earth caved in on them. Investigation of the area finds two storm drains, one which appeared to have caved in. The fire department is called to clear debris from the storm drain, but nothing is found inside. A local man states that the storm drain had caved in only a week earlier, and that in the hours after the children had been reported missing, police had searched the drain thoroughly. When asked about Croisset, Jim Beaumont states, quote, "We have a police force to cover all these things. I'm glad, and I will say it again, that I don't believe in clairvoyance," end quote. It is reported at the time that Jim and Nancy feel the involvement of Croisset is turning their tragic loss of children into a circus show for the media. While in town, Croisset receives a call from a local woman who informs him that the floor in a nearby warehouse has recently been poured with concrete. Croisset suddenly believes that the children are buried beneath this floor and requests the police dig it up. Police disagree, stating that the concrete had been poured within a week of the disappearance and that they had questioned the construction workers, who informed them that had there been bodies buried there, they certainly would have been discovered during their work. The South Australian government refuses to pay the cost to excavate the floor, but locals donate money, and soon $7,000 has been acquired, and the digging begins on March 1, 1967. According to the construction workers, children used to play in an abandoned kiln that had been buried in the area. After a week's worth of digging, no signs of the Beaumont children are found. Croisset argues that only one of the places he suggested was actually dug up, and until his dying day, claims that the children were buried beneath the concrete. Over the next 30 years, this location would be a hotbed for theories and questions. Several excavations would take place and multiple pits were found beneath the earth. On at least two separate occasions, cadaver dogs were brought in to search the area. On both trips, the dogs indicated the exact same spot, but upon investigating and digging, no evidence of the Beaumont children was located. The statements of Croisset were highly debated, with most attributing his claims as pure fraud. Regardless of the theories of Croisset, there doesn't appear to be any evidence to link the missing children with the concrete floor. In later years, Croisset's interpreter would state that Croisset actually believed the children were buried beneath an apartment complex, but didn't want anyone to lose their home, and so he suggested the warehouse instead. 2 years after the disappearance, in February of 1968, Jim and Nancy Beaumont receive a letter in the mail claiming to have been written by Jane, who would now be 11. The envelope showed that it was postmarked in Dandenong, Victoria, on February 21st. The handwriting did not resemble Jane's, but both Nancy Beaumont and investigator Stanley Swain believed that it was her who had written it. The letter said that the three children had been staying with a man and that they would be returned to their parents. The letter instructed Jim Beaumont to be standing in front of the Dandenong post office at 8:50 a.m. on Monday, February 26th, and to wear a dark coat and white trousers. The letter further stipulated that if police were told, the deal would be off. Curiously, Jane's sister Anna's name was misspelled in the letter, using only one N instead of two. The Beaumonts checked into the Commodore Motel in Dandenong with Swain and a man named Bill Cotton coming along for surveillance. In order to keep the operation secret, Victoria police were not told about the meeting. Unfortunately, someone tipped off the media, and they sent reporters to watch for the meeting. In addition to this, a local man reported Swain as a suspicious character in the area as there had been a recent string of robberies. And when Victoria police investigated and found out that Swain was an officer and that he had been working on the Beaumont children case, they became curious as to what he was doing in their area. Jim was standing at the post office at 8:50 a.m. while Swain wandered around pretending to be out for a walk but trying to keep the area under surveillance. At 9 a.m., postal employee Alice Parker received a phone call instructing her to deliver a message to the man outside. She went outside and informed Jim that a man with an Australian accent had called to say that he wouldn't be long. A short time later, a messenger boy came out of the post office and delivered a similar message to Jim. Though it isn't known for sure, it's believed that something in the message suggested to Jim that he should cross the street, which he did. A while later, another message came through saying that his son, Grant, was sick and that they wouldn't be along until after lunchtime. By 3 p.m., Jim had given up on waiting. He returned the next 2 days, but no further messages were delivered and his children were not returned to him. 3 more letters arrived at the Beaumont residence, with 2 claiming to have been written by Jane, and a 3rd in a different handwriting style was signed, quote, "The Man." The letters explained that the children would not be returned because Mr. Beaumont had informed the police about the arrangement. 13 years later, in 1981, the letters were re-examined by handwriting analysts, though nothing was found. 11 years after that, in 1992, new forensic approaches and fingerprinting techniques led to successfully identifying the author of the letters. The letters were written by a 41-year-old man who was 17 at the time they were written, who admitted to writing them as a joke. Jim Lister, the officer in charge of the Major Crime Task Force, issued a statement reading, quote, "We were able to confirm the letters were in fact written by a male person. They were a hoax, and they were in no way connected with the disappearance of the three children. I understand the person involved is extremely remorseful, and it would seem that an act that he carried out as an immature young person has come back to haunt him. Owing to the limitations of time statutes, no charges will be preferred." End quote. Few theories have been put forward in regard to the disappearance of the Beaumont children. For the most part, the most common theory is that the children were abducted and murdered. The abductor theory is by far the most popular, and as a result of this, several other cases with similarities were considered to be possible connections. In connection with these crimes come several possible suspects. In 1973, 11-year-old Joanne Ratcliffe and 4-year-old Kirsty Gordon disappeared from Adelaide Oval Stadium during a football match. The two girls were believed to have been abducted and murdered. At approximately 3:45 p.m., Kirsty asked to use the bathroom, and Joanne was sent to accompany her, and the two never returned. At 4:06 p.m., Miss Ratcliffe went to the secretary's office and requested that they page the girls. The secretary refused to do so, saying that it wouldn't be heard over the loud sound of the crowd. Miss Ratcliffe was told to return to her seat and to report the incident to police if the children didn't resurface. A 13-year-old boy reported seeing the girls coming down the stairs with an older man jogging after them. According to the boy, the man caught up to the girls, scooped one up, and headed toward the exit while the other girl looked scared and grabbed at the man. Witnesses placed the two girls in the company of an unidentified man within 90 minutes of their disappearance, and though descriptions were thin, the police sketch of the man resembled that of the blonde man who had been seen in the company of the Beaumont children. This case was never solved, and as recently as 2014, police have been following up on new leads. The two girls were last seen 3 kilometers from the Oval, approximately 90 minutes after they disappeared, in the company of an unidentified man. Another case with possible ties has come to be known as the family murders. In 1979, the body of 25-year-old Neil Muir was found in Adelaide. He had been mutilated and subjected to some form of surgery. In 1982, the mutilated body of 18-year-old Mark Langley was found. He had had surgery performed on him as well, with his abdomen partially shaved and sliced open and part of his bowel removed. His cause of death was due to loss of blood. For the next several months, more bodies were found, including 14-year-old Peter Stogniff and 18-year-old Alan Barnes. Later, they would discover the remains of 15-year-old Richard Kelvin. All victims had been mutilated in a similar fashion, and police believe the crimes were committed by more than one person. They have described the assailants as having a core group of 4 individuals with up to as many as 8 associates. Through the discovery of these murders, the police were able to locate a suspect who could possibly tie the so-called family murders to the disappearance of the Beaumont children. His name is Bevan Spencer von Einem. Bevan von Einem first came into the public eye when he was given the title of the Good Samaritan. On May 10th, 1972, 2 gay men were thrown into the River Torrens. The spot was well known as a place where homosexual men would meet up to engage in sexual acts covertly, as at that time, homosexual acts were illegal in South Australia. One of the men, Dr. George Duncan, drowned, and the other, Roger James, sustained a broken leg and began crawling towards the road where a passing von Einem spotted him and took him to the Royal Adelaide Hospital. James refused to identify his attackers, and it was long speculated that they had been police officers. The officers suspected of involvement were suspended and eventually resigned. On February 5th, 1986, 2 former police officers were arrested and charged with manslaughter in the death of Duncan, but were found not guilty. The officers refused to testify at trial. On June 6, 1983, Einem, with possible unidentified partners, abducted 15-year-old Richard Kelvin. Several witnesses heard cries for help, a door slamming, and a car with a noisy exhaust speeding away. Einem proceeded to torture, drug, rape, and hold Kevin captive for 5 weeks before brutally murdering him. Einem dumped his body near an airstrip in Kersbrook, northeast of Adelaide and near where Einem was living at the time. The body was not hidden, and Kelvin was still dressed in the clothing he was wearing the night he vanished. The body was posed in its fetal position. A coroner's inquisition found that Kelvin had died due to blood loss from an anal injury, likely caused by the insertion of a blunt object. Toxicology found traces of 4 hypnotic drugs, including Mandrax and Noctec. Police began searching for people with prescriptions to these drugs, and Einem's name came up on their list. Police were immediately interested as they had previously questioned Einem in connection with the murder of 3 other young men and the sexual assault of a 4th. Police questioned Einem, who claimed he was home sick the night Kelvin was murdered, but police found Mandrax in his home. He claimed to use the drug to aid with insomnia. When asked if he were in possession of any other drugs, he told the police he was not, but they also found Noctec in his home, hidden on a ledge behind his dresser. According to police, they were immediately suspicious of Einem when they knocked on his door, and his first response was that he wouldn't talk without a lawyer present. He also denied the presence of other drugs outside of Mandrax, and when confronted with the Noctec, informed police that he had only used it rarely. He was reported to seem nervous at this point in time, and police took samples of Einem's hair and blood along with swatches of his carpet. Forensic examination found matches to fibers found on Kelvin and the carpet samples they removed from Einem's home, and hairs that also matched Einem. The 1979 unsolved murder of 18-year-old Alan Barnes shared many similarities to that of Kelvin. An informant, known only as Mr. B, informed police that he and Einem used to pick up young men who were hitchhiking, take them back to Einem's home, where they would drug them, abuse them, and then turn them loose the next day. According to Mr. B, Others were involved as well, and he provided information about them, but insisted he himself had never been involved in any murders. The others he named were questioned, but refused to give information about the crimes. On November 3, 1983, Einem was arrested and charged with the murder of Richard Kelvin. Faced with overwhelming evidence, Einem changed his story and said that he had in fact been with Kelvin that night, but according to him, the two had only talked and spent time together in his home. Einem would claim that he dropped Kelvin off later that night and gave him $20 for a taxi ride home. Unfortunately for Einem, his new version of events presented two major issues. Firstly, it completely contradicted his original statement that he was homesick that night. And secondly, according to forensic examiners, the amount of fibers found on Kelvin were too many to have only been in Einem's home for just a few hours, and it was more likely that it had been days. During the course of his trial, Einem was implicated and charged in the murders of 18-year-olds Mark Langley and Alan Barnes. Mr. B, the prosecution's key witness, tied Einem to all of the murders, and during trial, alleged that Einem had also been involved in the disappearance of the Beaumont children, as well as the two girls who had been abducted from the Adelaide Oval. Unfortunately, there was no evidence nor witnesses who could corroborate these claims. Ultimately, Einem was convicted of the murder of Richard Kelvin. Though there doesn't appear to be enough evidence to convict him of the others, he is still considered their prime suspect. Einem was sentenced to life in prison and could not become eligible for parole until 2007. In the years since he was imprisoned, Einem has been the source of great speculation in relation to the disappearance of the Beaumont children, as well as several other unsolved crimes. On August 11, 2007, investigators made a request for information identifying a man seen on news footage in the days following the disappearance of the Beaumont children that appeared to show a young Bevan von Einem. In addition to this possible sighting, a man standing next to the alleged young Einem closely resembled the police sketch of the blonde man seen with the children on Australia Day in 1966. During his time in prison, Einem has been punished for raping other inmates as well as possibly possessing child pornography. Whether or not he is linked to the disappearance of the Beaumont children remains unknown, though many firmly believe he was involved. It should be noted, Einem would have been 31 years old in 1966, and a leaked confidential report lists Einem as a suspect in the Beaumont children's disappearance. Another suspect whose name is often associated with the disappearance of the Beaumont children is Arthur Stanley Brown. In 1998, Brown was charged with the 1970 murders of sisters Judith and Susan McKay, 7 and 5 years old, in Townsville, Queensland. The two girls vanished while on their way to school on August 26th. They were just 200 meters from their home when they went missing. Their bodies were recovered several days later in a dry creek bed 25 kilometers or 16 miles southwest of Townsville. Susan's body was found first, and footprints led from her remains to those of her sister. It was theorized that Susan had run away while her sister was being murdered, but that the killer had chased her down. Autopsies revealed that Susan had been raped, strangled, and stabbed 3 times in the chest. It's possible that the stab wounds were post-mortem. Judith had also been raped and stabbed 3 times in the chest, though her cause of death was listed as asphyxiation by sand. Their school uniforms, straw hats, and shoes were found beside their bodies. Their uniforms were folded neatly and placed inside their school bags, while each shoe contained a neatly folded sock. Unable to find any leads, police interviewed over 6,000 men in the area and came up empty-handed. They put together a $10,000 reward for any information leading to an arrest, and even offered a pardon for any accomplice who may have been involved. A witness came forward who had seen the girls talking to a man in a car at the bus stop at approximately 8:10 a.m. Just after 11 a.m., a similar car pulled into a filling station, purchasing $3 worth of gas. Jean Thwaite, an attendant at the gas station, recalled seeing the two girls in the car. According to her statement, one girl was quoted as asking, quote, "Are we there yet?" end quote, while the other girl asked, quote, "When are you taking us to Mummy? You promised to take us to Mummy," end quote. Shortly after this sighting, Neil Lunny, a soldier home from Vietnam, was cut off by a driver and spoke to him. According to Lunny, there were two girls in the car wearing school uniforms, and the driver was acting strange. Both accounts were dismissed, as both witnesses describe the car as being a Vauxhall, whereas other corroborated witnesses describe the vehicle as being a Holden. Despite the variation in model, both vehicles were described as being blue, and descriptions of the driver matched. The man was said to have high cheekbones, a narrow skull, short dark hair, and large protruding ears. Interestingly, the car was described as having a driver's door, which was a different color from the rest of the car. One witness would later identify Brown as being the driver that day. Brown was arrested and charged with the murders in 1998, when he was 86 years old. Interestingly, at the time of the crime, police were unable to locate the vehicle, but during the trial, which took place 28 years after, it was revealed that Brown had in fact owned a blue Vauxhall with an off-color driver's side door. Brown was arrested as a result of a phone call to Crime Stoppers placed by a cousin of his wife's. Following up on the call and interviewing family members of Brown's resulted in 45 instances of pedophilia related to Brown and circumstantial evidence linking him to the sisters' murders. Brown had been working as a carpenter at the school where the girls had attended and was reported to have been obsessed with the case, claimed to have known their father, and reportedly told his wife that he could take her to the murder scene. It was also discovered that on several occasions Brown had admitted to the murders. Brown was subsequently arrested on 45 counts of sexual assault and the rape of six children ages 3 to 10 years old, as well as for the murders of the McKay sisters. The trial officially began on October 18th, 1999. A jury was unable to reach a verdict, and in an attempt to pursue another trial, it was determined that Brown was unfit to stand trial as he was suffering from dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Brown died on July 6, 2002, at the age of 90. Ostracized by his family following his arrest, his stepson Robert spoke at his funeral saying, quote, "I can't believe such an insignificant little arsehole had such a profound effect on so many people's lives," end quote. Police have since closed the file on the McKay sisters' murder, fully believing that Brown was the killer. There are no hard links connecting Brown to the disappearance of the Beaumont children, and it's unknown if he had ever traveled to Adelaide. However, a witness claims to have had a conversation with Brown in which he stated that he had been to the Adelaide Festival Center. Brown also closely resembled the police sketch of the blonde man seen with the children the day they vanished. It's nearly impossible to track down Brown's whereabouts at the time, as a flood in Brisbane destroyed many records, and Brown had access to government sites related to his job, and could have possibly destroyed work records which would have placed him in the area. Regardless of the lack of evidence, next to Einem, Brown is considered by many to be one of, if not the, prime suspect in the disappearance of the Beaumont children. Another suspect, though to a lesser extent, is convicted murderer and suspected serial killer James Ryan O'Neill. In February of 1975, 9-year-old Ricky John Smith was abducted, and O'Neill participated in the search efforts for the boy. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, five other children were abducted, but all managed to escape. Later, 9-year-old Bruce Colin Wilson was abducted, and his body was found in May of 1975 near Ridson Vale. O'Neill was picked up as a suspect and subsequently led police to the body of Ricky Smith. O'Neill was arrested for both the murder of Smith and Wilson, but was only tried for Ricky Smith's murder. O'Neill pled insanity related to a gunshot wound he sustained in 1969 and later claimed that police had held a gun to his head in order to gain a confession from him. A jury deliberated for just 3 hours and found O'Neill guilty of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison and has applied for parole several times, though he's always denied, and today is the longest imprisoned man in Tasmania. It has been alleged that O'Neill may have been in Adelaide at the time the children disappeared. In the early 1970s, O'Neill reportedly told several people that he was responsible for the disappearance of the Beaumont children. O'Neill later claimed to have never been to Adelaide, although trips he took for his job would have him running through the area multiple times during the time that the children vanished. When O'Neill was asked point blankly whether or not he was involved in the disappearance, he responded, quote, "Look, on legal advice, I am not going to say where I was or when I was there," end quote. Some consider him a viable suspect, though South Australian police questioned him and ruled him out as a suspect. Others argue that he cannot be ruled out as a possibility. Then there is Alan McIntyre, often known as Maxed, who was accused of possible involvement in the disappearance by an unlikely source, his own son, Andrew McIntyre. According to a diary that Andrew kept in the 1960s, his father was President Glenelg Beach the day the Beaumont children vanished. The diary has since been turned over to Adelaide Police. It reportedly placed McIntyre and a family friend, Anthony Monroe, at the beach that day. According to Andrew, he was meant to go to the beach with his father and Monroe that day, but his invitation was rescinded at the last minute. According to Andrew, he remembers his father and Monroe seeming upset upon their return from the beach, and he recalls seeing blood and sand in Monroe's car. The story was corroborated by Andrew's sister, Ruth, who also claimed that she saw a child's body in the back of the car. Andrew admitted to being sexually assaulted by Monroe when he was a child, and the physical description of the unknown man seen with the Beaumont children fits well with Monroe's appearance in 1966. Just a few months ago, in June of 2007, Alan McIntyre died in a nursing home, forever releasing him from ever being tied to this case. Monroe is 75 years old today, and facing sentencing for 10 child sex offenses, including unlawful sexual intercourse against a child under 14, buggery, and gross indecency on Kangaroo Island, Rapid Bay, and Glenelg. Monroe was a scout leader back in the 1960s, and sexually assaulted multiple boys during this time. Following his time in Australia, he moved to Cambodia around 2008 and opened a so-called ladyboy bar, which he described as a gay-friendly bar. Monroe returned to Australia to answer questions regarding previous crimes and was tried for the 10 counts of sex offenses believed to have occurred between 1962 and 1983, for which he was found guilty. Cambodian officials were also investigating him for sexually assaulting two boys. Adelaide police questioned Monroe in regard to the Beaumont children, but have stated that they have no hard evidence which links him to the crime, though it is an ongoing investigation. Derek Percy has also been linked to the possible murder of the Beaumont children. Percy was in prison after pleading insanity when charged with the 1969 murder of Yvonne Toohey. According to reports of the time, Percy, a naval man, arrived on a beach in western Port Bay, Victoria while on leave for the weekend. He spotted 12-year-old Yvonne talking to her friend, 11-year-old Shane Spiller, and approached, grabbing Yvonne and holding a knife to her throat. It's believed he was also going to grab Shane, but Shane had a tomahawk with him and began flailing it at Percy. Percy fled with Yvonne, and Shane managed to give a full description of Percy, his vehicle, and a naval badge on the car. Police managed to find Percy within 3 hours of when he took Yvonne, and when they located him, he was washing blood out of his clothing. Percy was also linked to several other unsolved child murders, though he couldn't be officially tied to them. His insanity plea was partially based on a psychological condition in which he cannot remember his actions. He allegedly indicated that he may have been responsible for murdering the Beaumont children, but could not remember whether or not he did. He was known to be in the area at the time of their disappearance. On August 30th, 2007, Victorian police successfully were granted permission to question Percy in relation to the disappearance. Percy was 17 at the time of the crime, but wasn't known to have a car, and police firmly believe the responsible party had access to a vehicle. Percy died in 2013, having been in prison since 1969. In addition to possibly being involved in the abduction of the Beaumont children, Percy is also suspected of the double murder of Marianne Schmidt and Christy Sharrock, as well as the murders of Alan Redston, Linda Stillwell, and Simon Brooke. In October of 2014, he was formally ruled to have abducted and murdered 7-year-old Linda Stillwell in 1969. It is strongly believed that the Beaumont children were abducted on the last day they were seen, and that the abductor likely murdered them and disposed of their bodies within the first 12 hours. Initially, police considered the possibility that the children were swept into the sea and drowned, but this was ruled out when they failed to locate any items belonging to the children, and they consider it highly unlikely that the children and all of their belongings and clothing would be swept away without something resurfacing. In November of 2013, a factory in North Plimpton was excavated based on a tip about the Beaumont children. Ground-penetrating radar found a small anomaly, but further digging found nothing. In the 51 years since the disappearance, very little new leads have been developed, and all suspects are connected only through circumstantial evidence at best. For many years following the loss of their children, Jim and Nancy Beaumont continued to live in the same home together. But when the pain and stress became too much, the two divorced and moved away, beginning new lives, but never forgetting about their lost children. Both chose to avoid the public eye and to live quiet, restrained lives far from the terrible memories of that Australia Day in 1966. Just days before the 50th anniversary of the disappearance in 2016, Detective Superintendent Des Bray said police still receive a call every four or so days in relation to the case. In the previous 2 years, over 160 calls had come in. Bray stated, quote, "There have been hundreds of people put forward over time. The window of opportunity to get a result is in decline. The person who committed these offenses, if alive today, would be between the ages of 70 and 100. End quote. If alive today, Jane Beaumont would be 60, Anna would be 58, and Grant would be 56. Their disappearance sparked change in Australia, signaling the end of the carefree unlocked doors and everybody knows everybody mentality. It rung in a time of strangers lurking on the street corners, an air of suspicion and doubt. It became the most widely covered crime in the history of Australia to that time, and despite witnesses and leads, the answer as to what happened to the children was never found. Their lives were stolen from them, and in addition to the loss of their lives, their parents were sent spiraling into the darkness of grief and the pain of the unknown. Someone is responsible for what happened, and someone knows the answers. Whether or not that person is still alive, we can't know for sure, and whether or not we ever found out what happened to Jane, Anna, and Grant Beaumont is a mystery that becomes less and less likely of being solved with each passing day. The disappearance of the Beaumont children is one of the most famous missing persons cases in all of Australia. Many people designate Australia Day 1966 as a day where innocence was forever lost and the perception of close neighbors and quiet towns changed. Retrospect always comes with a certain rosy tint, and I've certainly read accounts of others who feel the dangers are always known and the tragedy of the Beaumont children was another indication that we live in a dangerous world and not even innocent children are safe. Regardless, it's one of those boogeyman stories kids are told about, how you should never talk to strangers. I first learned of this case several years ago and was surprised that I hadn't heard of it before, but that isn't all that uncommon. Many sad and fascinating cases from outside of the United States aren't given as much attention as they could be, for whatever reason, be it ratings or local interest, or simply an arbitrary decision. For me, the disappearance of the Beaumont children is as captivating as it is heartbreaking. Although this case has been on my list for a while, I wasn't initially planning to touch on it yet. It was in the undecided column, as though it's a case which deserves a great deal of attention. It's been covered by many different outlets. Several other podcasts have covered the Beaumont children, and there have been several books and countless newspaper articles. Then I began going back through my messages from listeners, and I discovered that the disappearance of the Beaumont children was the case with the most requests. For months now, I've wanted to do an episode which focuses on an Australian case, being that such a large contingent of listeners are in Australia. I wanted to pick the right case, and I initially had a completely different case lined up, but based on requests, I thought I'd cover this one. Interestingly, I found that, for most of the requests, listeners didn't think I was going to find any new revelations, but they wanted to hear me apply my thoughts to the theories and suspects. I hope you'll be satisfied with the results. The case has become extremely popular since the advent of the internet, and several theories have been suggested. Most of the theories revolve around abduction, but vary based upon who is believed to have been involved. There's a short suspect list, but there hasn't been enough evidence to link any particular individual or group of people to the crime. Almost immediately, the police ruled out the possibility of a runaway. They also found nothing in their investigation to suggest that the children had anything to run away from. I would have to agree with the dismissal of running away as a possibility. The children frequented the beach, had gone and come back multiple times, and by all accounts, belonged to a loving family. There's a theory that the children could have been swept into the ocean and drowned. Although this is possible, I have to agree with police in that I believe something would have washed ashore eventually or a body would have been found. I think one person, and maybe even two, could vanish into the ocean. But to believe all three disappeared along with 17 different items they had with them and nothing ever showed up again, that's very difficult for me to swallow. The most popular theory, and in my opinion the most likely, is that the children were abducted. The interesting question is whether or not it was an abduction by someone they had just met, or if it's possible that they were abducted by someone they had spent time with previously. Police have theorized over the years that it's entirely possible the children had known their abductor, at least to some degree. There's also the statement from Anna that Jane had a boyfriend at the beach. Is it possible that she was referring to the man who would later abduct them? Absolutely. The children were reportedly comfortable around him, comfortable enough to laugh and play with him, and to likely have taken some money from him in order to purchase a meat pie and snacks with a £1 note. Also, we have to consider the clothing changing. Nancy was adamant that Jane was a very shy girl, and she found it incredibly hard to believe that she would have allowed a stranger to change her, especially in public. This, coupled with the way witnesses say she behaved around the man, leads me to believe that the child likely met the man before and had some level of time developing trust and comfort with him. This would also lend itself to being one of the reasons the children were never found. If this crime had been conducted by someone who planned to earn their trust, he would likely have also planned out exactly what he would do after taking them. The sheer fact that no trace of the children was ever found makes me think this wasn't just a random snatch-and-grab job. It was clearly thought out and executed efficiently. Some people, though, do believe it was just a random grab, but again, I find that hard to believe. First and foremost, we have the witness accounts. But in addition to that, we aren't talking about grabbing a child and running off with her. There are three children involved, and trying to take control of three without drawing attention to what was happening would have been extremely difficult. If you've been around children much, it's hard to control one, let alone three. I think a perfect stranger would have difficulty trying to get them to go along with him, though it can't be completely ruled out. If perhaps he had a weapon and threatened one, the others might go along with it. There's also the possibility that the abductor tried to trick the children, saying that he had lost a puppy or that their parents were hurt and he was sent to get them. Again, though, we know the children were playing with the man earlier in the day, and to me, this makes it extremely unlikely that he tried to pull one of those tricks on them. All of this follows the thought process that the man they were seen with is the man who would abduct them. And that's not necessarily what happened, although it does seem like it's most likely. I have to believe if the man who was seen with the children that day was not the one who abducted them, at some point in time, he would have come forward and explained what he had seen and what he had experienced that day. According to recent statistics, there are three types of child abductors. Family member abductors, which accounts for 49% of all child abductions. Acquaintance abductions, which accounts for 27%. And stranger abductions, which accounts for 24%. That means that in 76% of child abductions, the perpetrator knew the victim, at least in some way. Interestingly, most family abductors involve a higher percentage of female perpetrators than others, but the majority of stranger abductions target female victims. It's extremely rare for three children to be taken all at once. In 80% of stranger abductions, the first contact between the victim and the abductor takes place within a quarter mile of the child's home, and 74% of the victims are female. Also, 74% of abducted children who become murder victims are murdered within 3 hours of their abduction. This fits with the police theory that the children were likely murdered within hours of their abduction. Out of the abductor theory came a handful of possible suspects. Each of them is connected to other crimes against children in some way. Some were convicted of their crimes, while others were never tried or couldn't be tried. The first suspect, and the one who is primary on most people's lists, is Bevan von Einem. Einem was alleged to have worked with a group of other twisted killers, but none of these people has ever been arrested or tried in connection with any of the crimes for which Einem was suspected to be responsible. Einem was tried and convicted of the murder of Richard Kelvin. He's suspected in 5 other murders. The only piece of information which linked Einem to the Beaumont children was testimony by a confidential informant named Mr. B, who is alleged to have been involved in the rape of young men in conjunction with Einem. Although Einem is clearly a twisted individual with sick tendencies and a history of murder, there are several details about his crimes which make me personally think he wasn't responsible for the disappearance of the Beaumont children. First and foremost, Einem targeted males. He was homosexual, or at least bisexual, and admittedly engaged in sex acts with men, both with and without their consent. The youngest victim to whom he is connected is the one for whom he was sentenced to life, 14-year-old Richard Kelvin. He didn't appear to target children as young as the Beaumonts, and with his predilection for males, it would be extremely out of character that he would be drawn to a four-year-old boy, such as Grant, although there have been reports that he's been in possession of child pornography while in jail. You also have to consider the manner in which he disposed of the bodies. Einem wasn't much for covering his tracks, and in almost every single murder for which he is suspected, the bodies were merely dumped in locations where they were quickly found. All of these details make it hard for me to put Einem as the man responsible for the disappearance. It's said that Einem resembled the composite sketch of the unidentified man seen with the Beaumont children. But as I've said previously, the sketch is extremely vague. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that Einem could have been involved in the crime, or perhaps even associated with someone responsible for it. But for me, I don't think he's the most likely suspect. Police differ in opinion, and it was leaked that a confidential document lists him as a suspect. I certainly think he should be looked at in connection with the crime, but he's been serving a life sentence in prison since 1983, and no charges in relation to the case have ever been levied against him. Another suspect was Arthur Stanley Brown. Brown is certainly a likely candidate, and his targeted victims fit more in line with the ages of the Beaumont children. At the time of his arrest, he was charged with 45 instances of pedophilia. He was also charged with the murder of the McKay sisters, who vanished on their way to school. Their bodies were found in a dry creek bed. Both girls had been raped and stabbed. Brown had worked at their school and was reportedly obsessed with the case, even going so far as to admit that he was responsible. His entire connection to the case stems from a witness who claims that during a conversation with Brown, he admitted to being in Adelaide around the time of the crime, and his physical appearance matches the composite drawing. It's fairly thin evidence, and there's nothing that links him to the Beaumont children other than that. Unlike Einem, he was known to target children, specifically young girls. Many people consider him to be the most likely suspect, but it's hard for me to put him at the top of the list. He was never convicted of any of the crimes for which he was tried. A hung jury resulted in the need for a second trial, and by the time it came around, Brown was deemed mentally unfit to stand trial. He died in 2000, and though no convictions were achieved, the police believe he was responsible for the murder of the McKay sisters and have since closed the case. Brown is a possibility, and a good one, but it's really hard to say he's most likely, since there's never been a single piece of verifiable evidence to link him to the disappearance of the Beaumont children. James Ryan O'Neill has been considered a suspect by some. He's currently serving a life sentence for the 1975 murder of 9-year-old Ricky John Smith. He's suspected in the abduction and murder of several others, though no evidence has been provided to link him directly. O'Neill strikes me as the type who likes the attention he gets from his possible connections to other murders. When asked about the Beaumont children, he doesn't deny it. He simply refuses to answer the question based on advice from his lawyer. If he truly wanted his name erased from that connection, he'd have something else to say. I don't think O'Neill was involved in the abduction. There just isn't anything to connect him. His alleged involvement in the case stems from him supposedly telling others that he was responsible. It's hard to know for sure, but considering the way he seems to revel in the attention, I wouldn't be surprised in the least if he had claimed to have been involved just to get that attention. O'Neill is serving life for crimes, and outside of refusing to answer the questions about the Beaumont children, he's never had anything else to say on the matter. Andrew McIntyre came forward not long ago and stated that he believes his father, Alan Max McIntyre, and his good friend, Anthony Allen Monroe, may have been responsible for the disappearance. Reportedly, there's a diary which dates back to 1965, and Andrew was one of the contributors to this diary, referred to as the Salvage and Exploration Club Diary. Andrew, now 63 years old, released a statement saying, quote, "The day the Beaumont children disappeared was a shocking day in history that stands out in my memory very clearly. I believe Tony and Max were involved in the disappearance of the Beaumont children." End quote. Essentially, Andrew has said that he was supposed to go to Glenelg Beach with his father on Australia Day in 1966, but that at the last minute, his father told him he couldn't go and instead went to the beach with Tony Monroe. As early as 2007, McIntyre's daughter, Ruth Collins, made allegations to police that she believed her father was responsible for the crime. Police did investigate, but were unable to find any evidence linking McIntyre to the disappearance. Now that Andrew has come forward with the diary, which places his father and Monroe at the Glenelg Beach that day, the investigation has heated back up. A police spokeswoman stated, quote, Police have undertaken many actions and lines of inquiries in relation to this matter. There is no evidence at all to support these claims." End quote. According to Andrew, upon McIntyre and Monroe's return from Glenelg Beach that day, both were visibly upset. Andrew says they were standing by the car with their hands on their head muttering, "Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit." He also claims to have seen blood and sand in the car, while his sister has said she saw at least one child's body in the car and that her father's shirt was covered in blood. They've said they believe the bodies are inside of a filled-in well on McIntyre's property outside of Adelaide. McIntyre would die before he could ever be thoroughly looked at following links to the diary, but Monroe remains alive today and is currently in custody awaiting sentencing for the 10 child sex offenses for which he was found guilty. Interestingly, there's some belief that police did not want to investigate McIntyre because he had worked for them before. McIntyre worked for the phone company, and some have suggested that he tapped phone lines for police investigations in the past, and that this may have afforded him some leeway with their investigation. Monroe, on the other hand, is a former Boy Scout leader with a long history of child abuse and pedophilia. Many link Monroe to the disappearance, as he resembles the composite of the man seen with the Beaumont children that day, as well as fitting the description of the blonde-haired man. This is one of the more recent sets of suspects, and without further investigation, it's difficult to see a link other than the fact that they were reportedly in the area of Glenelg Beach on that terrible day in 1966, and their kids believe that they saw either a dead child or blood or both on them when they returned. Although I think these are viable suspects who warrant further investigation, it does seem out of character. Their behavior was typically to sexually assault younger children, but in no other instances are they accused of murder. Andrew McIntyre himself claims to have been sexually assaulted by Monroe many times over the years. It's quite a leap to go from assaulting children to whom you have access, as Monroe would have done as a scout leader and a friend of Andrew's father, to a brazen broad daylight grab of three small children and then to murder them. I certainly think there's something here, and probably the more digging investigators do, the more likely they are to find links to other crimes against children, but I'm not sure I can see the connection to the Beaumont children. Andrew and his sister have accused the men of being responsible, and alleged to have seen evidence to link them to it, but one would have to wonder why they waited over 40 years before saying anything about it to authorities. These two are a possibility, and perhaps more evidence will be found, but until that happens, it's very difficult to tie them to the crime. McIntyre is now deceased, and Monroe is facing spending the rest of his life in jail. Police may attempt to get him to talk in some kind of a deal, but short of a confession, it's almost impossible to tie either man to the children. This final suspect, often considered a viable answer to the question of who took the Beaumont children, is Derek Percy. Percy is fascinating in connection to this case for multiple reasons. First, he's in prison for murdering Yvonne Toohey in 1969, just 3 years after the Beaumont children disappeared. When Percy was arrested for her murder, he claimed to have memory issues which would make it difficult for him to explain what happened. In order to get as many answers as he could, the investigating officer worked the timeline backwards, first having Percy lead him to the body, which he was able to do. Percy grabbed Yvonne in broad daylight on a beach and in front of her friend, and this makes a lot of people believe it's highly possible he would have done the same thing to the Beaumont children. He held a knife to Yvonne's throat to get her to come along, and many suspect he may have wielded a weapon on one of the Beaumont children to convince the others to come along as well. Percy pled innocent by reason of insanity and was remanded to a prison on a psych evaluation. Years later, while incarcerated, Percy was referred to by guards as a Hannibal Lecter-like inmate with a high intelligence. Interestingly, he was a chess player and would later come out and make claims that he wasn't insane, and there was a lot of controversy in the papers regarding a possible release at the time. He has been suspected in many other crimes, including the disappearance of the Beaumont children. He was a violent man with psychological problems who didn't hesitate to commit a heinous crime against a child. Whether or not he has any true links to the disappearance, we may never know. And Percy was tight-lipped, never answering any questions about any other crimes for which he was considered a suspect. He died of cancer in 2013 at the age of 64, possibly taking many answers with him. To me, Percy's an interesting suspect, and certainly possible. Whether or not he is more or less likely than anyone else is difficult to determine. Percy is often dismissed as a suspect because at the time of the murder he was 17 years old and didn't have access to a car, which police believe was necessary to have gotten the children away without anyone noticing. There is the possibility, though, that Percy could have been involved with someone else, or that he borrowed a car from a friend or family member. It's strange to write him off as a suspect based on such a weak set of information. Perhaps police know more than they're saying, which is usually the case with an ongoing investigation. But after 51 years, you'd imagine they might have be a little more forthcoming with any details they may have regarding the investigation that they have yet to release. It's challenging dealing with this list of suspects. You have a cluster of a bunch of horrible people who are all capable of and responsible for terrible actions. All we can truly do is look at the evidence and see what fits and what doesn't. Each suspect fits in some ways and not in others, so it's a back to square one approach every time you look at a different name. When you look at the crimes which are solved years after they took place, in many instances, you'll find perpetrators' names were in the original case files. Police usually suspected the culprit early on or interviewed him as part of their investigation. In this case, the police were unable to find anything which might provide answers, but we do know that several of these names were in the file. Was one of them responsible? I think there's only two possibilities. Either one of these people committed this terrible crime, or one of these men knows who did. Pedophiles and child murderers often communicate with each other and revel in their exploits. And men who lived in that dark world, even if not directly responsible, have likely heard tale of who was. The question is, without corroboration, could you really trust anything any of them had to say? There is also the possibility that the person or persons responsible may not yet be known to anyone. The police continue to receive tips and leads in this case. Between 2014 and 2016, there were 159 tips called into Crime Stoppers. It's a tragic story which galvanized the public and forever changed the way people viewed their homeland of Australia. People clung a little more closely to their children and advised them more thoroughly of the dangers of strangers. It's a well-known story, one which every Australian person I've ever spoken to is familiar with. It's hard to imagine that 51 years later, we're ever going to see a live recovery of Jane, Anna, or Grant. I agree with investigators that it's most likely that they were abducted and murdered within hours of their disappearance. Whoever was responsible had some way to dispose of the children and their belongings without them ever being found. But Australia is a vast continent with plenty of places to hide something if you don't want it to be found. It's a really heartbreaking story. Every case involving a child is somehow more disturbing than those with an adult. In this case, three innocent children had their futures taken from them by a sick individual or group of persons, and 51 years later we have no answers. Jim and Nancy Beaumont never found out what happened to their three beautiful children. In 1990, a computer-generated image was released of what the children might look like at that time. Nancy and Jim requested that the pictures not be released, but several newspapers ran with them, and Nancy was reported to have been devastated and couldn't look at the photos. The impact of the loss on their marriage was too great to bear, and eventually the two divorced and moved away. Police maintain contact with them, and every time a new suspect is named or a new location of a possible burial site is released, they cooperate and are involved, but for the most part, they live quiet lives far away from the probing eye of the public. Today, Jim is 91 and Nancy is 89, and for the past 51 years they have been haunted by what happened to their children and the absence of any answers to their questions. Somewhere on the continent of Australia, somebody knows more than they've said. Jane, Anna, and Grant did not simply disappear that day in 1966. They were taken, and whoever took them knows where they ended up, and to this day, they have remained hidden away and are yet to be found. Perhaps someday we will get answers, and Jim and Nancy could be granted closure and justice before their lives come to an end. Until that time, the disappearance of the Beaumont children remains one of the most disturbing and unanswered questions in Australia and all around the world. If you're interested in finding more information about the disappearance of Jane, Anna, and Grant Beaumont, there are many websites and forums where you can find information about the case. If you have any information about their disappearance, please contact Crime Stoppers or your local police. What do you think happened to the Beaumont children? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence, and invite you to check out our website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to our Patreon, all of our social media accounts, as well as places to download and subscribe to the podcast. I'm always eager to hear your feedback. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases we cover. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.